Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a great episode coming up for you tonight. Lots of stuff in the news, and we're going to kind of jump in and cover a little bit of everything tonight, and then wrap up with a little bit on some review of blast injury mechanics and things like that, mechanism of injury. So let's go ahead and get to that. But of course, you know, the person who pulls us all together, the glue that keeps the podcast moving, is Sam Bradley. Sam, how you doing?
Yes, Jamie. Yeah, we're fairly dry here, which is not, that can't be said for a lot of people. And we're going to talk about that in a second. You know, I was thinking earlier, 2020 has actually done us a favor with all this craziness going on. We never had, you know, nothing to talk about. There you go. So, Miss Becky, Joe and I are calling it number 9 because we don't know how to pronounce the darn thing, but what did it do?
Yeah, so Hurricane Isaias was actually pretty impactful to, in particular, the Northeast. Certainly some sort of reminiscent of a Sandy and Irene. Some places saw higher wind gusts and more rainfall, some saw less, but I'll throw out a few sort of highlights of what occurred. So it did make landfall in the Carolinas and then moved very quickly through the Delmarva and then into New England. At one point, over 3 million people were without power. The high rainfall amount was over 8 inches, 8.18 inches in Wynnewood, Pennsylvania. Philadelphia actually set a daily rainfall record from this hurricane, or at that point, tropical storm. Several wind gusts in Delaware, Virginia, in the lower to mid 90 mile per hour range. There were a couple of different tornadoes. It's funny, we vacationed at the Jersey Shore, and the causeway that we take over to the island, we go to Long Beach Island, there's a weather station right at that causeway that was hit by a tornado and recorded a wind gust of 109 miles per hour. So really some pretty intense winds from Isaias, a ton of rainfall. Unfortunately, that also resulted in a lot of downed trees. You get the rainfall saturating the ground, then you get the wind gusts. Overall, not a good situation. Jamie, what did you see there in Maryland?
Yeah, it was, I was telling people, I felt like I was inside a washing machine here at my house. You know, I was sitting here working where I normally work with up in the corner of our bedroom with the windows right next to me. And, you know, it was just water and rain hitting on the windows from, I start pretty early in the morning, and it ran until about 2 to 3 in the afternoon. And then the sun came out and the skies were blue and, you know, it was great. And there was a tree down at the end of our street. And, you know, I mean, it was kind of nuts. My daughter came home from work. She had to go into work that morning, and she said there were trees down all over the place on her way home. She kept having to drive around things and, you know, to get home. And I know up in Chester County, Pennsylvania, there are places that they're telling them they're not going to get power back we're recording Thursday night here. They were talking like Saturday, Sunday till some of these places could get power.
Yeah, it was a pretty intense storm. It also produced 37 tornadoes between Monday and Tuesday from the Carolinas all the way up through, I think, southern New England. Even may have seen a few. Maybe like Jersey was the farthest north. But overall, it actually a pretty impactful storm for, you know, being, as we say, just a tropical storm. Just a good reminder that we shouldn't focus on category. We should always focus on the impacts, which in this case were a lot of rain, some really high wind gusts, and tornadoes, flooding from the rain.
It sounded like Kyle there for a minute. That's what he always says. So is there anything else brewing out there, Bex?
No, thankfully. No. So it's all quiet right now. Nothing is listed on the National Hurricane Center as, you know, even of no chances right now. But that said, the National Hurricane Center, as well as CSU, as well as AccuWeather, have all revised their hurricane outlook for the season. And the numbers are higher, which is not a good thing. It means we're expecting an even worse season than we were initially, which isn't all that surprising considering we're on our 9th storm. And pretty much every storm we've had has been the earliest storm for that letter. So it's already a very intense season, and I don't think it's going to get any better.
I saw something about it was the second almost, you know, the second to the most named storms in this period of time.
Yeah, so 2005 currently has the most named storms. That was the year we did have to go into the Greek alphabet. We're basically expecting that to happen again. So once we run out of, there are 21 named storms. We don't do X, Y, Z, and Q, I think are the letters we don't name, and maybe one other. So once we run out of those 21 names, we then go into the Greek alphabet. And that has only happened since we started naming storms in 2005, I believe.
Well, let's hope the next one's Jack. That'd be a whole lot easier to pronounce. Okay. Well, moving right along, the other big story in the news, and hi, Dr. Joe. I didn't want to forget you up there in the corner.
Hi, everybody.
Of course, things are probably status quo in Memphis, huh?
Well, you know, we're COVID-ing right along, so... I guess we're doing okay. Things are busy, but we're hanging in.
Ah, Josephine, thanks, Becky. I can live with that. Anyway, as we all know by now, Beirut. I mean, the magnitude of this thing is crazy. They speculate that like 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate, which is highly explosive and used in fertilizers, had been stored at this port facility for 6 years. And, you know, there's a lot of political stuff going on behind that, which we're not going to get into. But it cut loose. And the videos, and Joe, I want to talk about this with you. What really blew me away is the shockwave. There's one, somebody put up a link in the community where you see the explosion down this road, like it seems like 100 miles away, and then boom, within seconds, it blows away this guy and his car and everything else. I mean, it's just insane the kind of damage that was done. The latest stats I could find was 135 dead, and of course we know that's going to raise, and we don't know how many are missing, but at least 2,000 injured and 300,000 people displaced. Then, of course, we got the issues of the toxicity, and I don't know, Becky, is there a weather element here we need to worry about for them? Is this cloud of toxic stuff going anywhere? I wasn't sure about that.
That's a really good question, one I don't actually have the answer to, but let me see if I can find out anything and come back to me.
Copy that. Let me know when you find something. So anyway, that's kind of where it is right now. There's 1,000 questions going through my head, as it would in any kind of disaster. Like, you know, what is there? Where can they put people if most of the city is gone? Jamie, you got a question on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I know I've been following this pretty closely in the news, and you know, there's a lot of challenges that are going around this, not just the fact that this disaster happened, but the fact that the city of Beirut, and in fact the country of Lebanon, was about to go on a 5 to 7 day lockdown because of COVID increases in the communities there. And so you can only imagine how the hospitals were already stressed. 3 hospitals were damaged in this thing. And I can only imagine, Joe, what kind of stresses that puts on the medical community. To have to cope with having COVID going on, already full hospitals, and then just this inundation of trauma victims.
I completely agree, Jamie. You know, it is tragedy on top of tragedy. You're right. There was a pretty significant COVID surge going on there that was already stressing out the infrastructure of the city, which is suffering from lots of political and internal strife already. And on top of that, you drop a 2.2 kiloton explosion, which is apparently about what 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate is equivalent to when we think about nuclear weapons and that sort of stuff. So an incredibly devastating blast. I think everyone's seen the pictures of a brand new lake on the beachfront. Entire building's completely gone. A cruise ship knocked on its side that was a couple miles away, and devastation across an entire city during a time where people are trying to isolate and stay out of harm's way to some extent.
Yeah, I mean, you see different people saying Beirut is gone. I mean, you got to wonder how much of that city is actually left. Is everybody going to have to evacuate? And I'm looking at your USAR side here, Joe, but what are they going to do with these people? Because of the toxicity, it's just not a matter of finding a place to put them. It's a safe place to put them, which may be far away. Reflect on the USAR piece of this, what it must be like.
Hell no. I think in many cases the challenge here is thousands upon thousands of homeless people that are going to have to be put someplace because a significant portion of the infrastructure of that city from a housing standpoint has been destroyed. I cannot imagine that power and water and those sort of things are functional either. A healthcare system that is overwhelmed by orders of magnitude. And the challenge from a USAR side of trying to set up operations in a place like that, do the best you can to protect yourself from chemical hazards that are likely present, devastated buildings that are likely crumbling as you walk through them. By the way, there's a pandemic going on all at the same time. So the complications here almost boggle the mind. And kudos to those that are out there doing that work. It's got to be among the most difficult challenges I can imagine.
Agree. 2020 just found a new low. I mean, I can't think of it. You know, I think you said earlier in another podcast, Jamie, if we wrote a book about this, nobody would believe it. It would be total science fiction. And here we are living in the middle of it. Well, Becky can't see any weather connection. Go ahead and tell us what you put in the sidebar there, Beck.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not seeing anything. So my guess is that there wasn't much of a chemical cloud left after the blast dispersed all the ammonium nitrate. So the main weather impact would be, the cleanup that's going on. But I think it's fairly dry and hot, so I don't see any major weather impacts at the moment. But this is obviously going to be a very long-term thing, so that could change.
Yeah. Well, what kind of weather is there at this time of year? Are they going to have any storms or anything else that will further complicate this scenario?
I don't think so. I used to forecast for this part of the country, for this part of the world, but it's been a while. Let me take a look here. Just one second.
At her fingertips, she has the weather of the world right there.
I mean, it's hot.
Well,
hot and dry.
Yeah. I didn't know what time the rainy season was that in that part of the world that they might have to deal with any kind of rain, because I know it's dry most of the time.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Not this time of year.
Well, that's a good thing for them. At least something's working in their favor. The big question is, and I have some folks I hope to get on with us that can give us more specific information, but the big questions are, what are they doing with evacuations? Where are these people going? What are they doing about health care? What are they doing with the dead? All those kinds of questions. Joe, you have a thought?
Well, I was just going to sort of follow up on Becky's comment a minute ago, and that is I think that the majority of the chemical concerns are the concerns about a chemical exposure related to ammonium nitrate, et cetera, it's not huge anyway, but that I think the vast majority of that was consumed in the explosion and fire, and so not an awful lot left to be very concerned about from a necessarily inhalational standpoint, apart from the massive amount of dust, et cetera, that is part of any major earth-shaking explosion, et cetera.
And Sam, I'll just chime in here as well. You know, you were talking about where do the people go and where do the resources come to serve the medical needs of these communities. I know several of the countries in that region, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, I think as well, Iraq, are all sending field hospitals units, you know, mobile field hospital units down to Lebanon and Beirut specifically to supplement the hospital systems that are overwhelmed there. But, you know, that also then takes away resources from those communities in the midst of the pandemic and exposes them to an area that is already under a surge. So it really, I mean, this is putting stresses on that entire region, I suspect, or will put stresses on that region as people return from deployment to manage this, because this is not going to be something that's going to be resolved very quickly, because, you know, the injuries are severe. You know, they're still digging people out of buildings there. And it's going to go on for some time.
Well, if we in America pay any attention to this, I think the lesson is quit whining. It could be worse, because they definitely have it worse. We still deal with COVID and social unrest and all of that, but, you know, nothing like these folks are dealing with out there. So we're thinking about you people. So, Joe, I remember in studying blast injury, there were like three levels of injury. The blast itself, the shock wave, and then what happens when you come down out of the air and land on something. Would that be close?
Yeah, you're pretty close there. There are sort of multiple different types of injury from the, you know, the effects of the blast itself literally blowing you into pieces, to the shrapnel injuries of having pieces blown into you, and then the pressure effects, which can be quite substantial and quite devastating, and then additional effects like, as you mentioned, Sam, what you were thrown into by the effect of that blast and or pressure wave, and then you know, the fact that you landed someplace that's now on fire. So there's lots of different ways for explosive and blast injuries to do you lots of harm. It is not an ideal situation to have yourself in any way at all. On top of all that, you're going to catch COVID after you're done. So, you know, you just can't win here, I think.
Oh, those poor people. Our friend KK Panjet, who brought up, sent me a lot of information on text, was saying that they're leaning on him to talk about how do you triage these kinds of injuries. So there you are, Joe, at a USAR conference in Lebanon, and everything blows up, but of course you're okay because, you know, nothing can hurt you. And they go, Joe, where do we start? How are we going to triage this mess all over what used to be Beirut?
Wow. yeah, what an overwhelming question to be asked, honestly. You know, I think the approach here is no different than it is to any other major disaster. Obviously, search and rescue teams were in the field fairly quickly as soon as things began to settle down. The needs assessment and damage assessment is obviously continuously ongoing, as the search and rescue efforts. But I think the real challenge here is a lot of the stuff you've already mentioned, which is the restoration of a healthcare infrastructure, the need to find, move, house, and medically treat the population of an entire city, just about, in a location remote from where they are, because that infrastructure is so damaged already, and the idea of housing or caring for or feeding or moving those patients and people, those who happen to not be injured, that all of those things result in people being very close together in a time where PPE is hard to come by, and obviously, leads to a very high probability of you know, the continued insult of a couple of weeks down the road when your search and rescue efforts are beginning to wind down a little bit, and maybe you've got some DMAT-type teams in place providing emergency medical care in temporary structures and all that sort of stuff, and now you're overwhelmed with a wave of COVID-positive patients that have nowhere to go for healthcare and are presenting themselves to a system that was barely hanging on before. Man, like I said earlier, it's just layer upon layer of complexity and challenge here.
Well, let's hope that other countries are able to send a lot of resources, even though it's a COVID-related country. But let's face it, there isn't anywhere in the world that isn't at the moment. But, you know, what you're saying makes a lot of sense, because you're going to have to separate, if possible, those COVID patients from the non-COVID patients. But I don't even know how they're going to do that. That's just insane. Any thoughts from you, Jamie?
Well, I think that, you know, the thing that strikes me is, you know, when you were talking about triage, and I just kind of like, you know, put my paramedic hat back on and remembered, you know, a lesson that I learned early on was you just got to pick a spot and start. You know, triage is you know, you take the resources you have and you start somewhere, because if you try to do everything at once, you won't get anything done. And I think that that's the lesson here. You know, Joe said, like it is with every disaster, resources are overwhelmed in one sort or another. This is, of course, an extreme example and something that we won't likely, hopefully, fingers crossed because it's 2020, see again anytime soon. But it is the lesson here is, you know, when you get into this situation and you arrive on the scene and you're one of the first units on location, you know, it is apply yourself one step at a time, pick a spot, start working with that patient, do your triage, move on and until more resources get there. And, you know, I know that's something that Joe's been teaching for a long time. I mean, we've all learned, we've all taught, if we're educators, and it just, I think it bears repeating. Don't you agree, Joe?
Absolutely, Jamie. You know, you're right on target. There's sort of nothing special about this from the standpoint of the approach is the same. It's all about preparedness, and it's all about attempting to get in there quickly and begin to reestablish some order and infrastructure in multiple different ways. This one is going to be very hard, very complicated, very long, very costly, both in terms of the financial impact and lives lost, whether that's directly related to this blast or to the subsequent consequences of overcrowding and et cetera with COVID in the area already.
You know what this reminds me of, Jamie, was when our friend Chris was with us talking about his first experience with an F5 tornado in Oklahoma, and, you know, when it basically took out more of Oklahoma, but that too. But that's basically what the ambulance has to do because they couldn't go anywhere. You know, they were faced with fallen trees and all the rest of it. And basically, they set up their ambulance as a triage point, and they assessed and threw people in the back of pickup trucks, and at least they had some place to take them. I'm not so sure that's happening in Beirut, but, you know, it makes perfect sense because there will not be any kind of central command for quite a long time. It's going to just be...
Well, you know, I saw, and I'm sure you've seen some of the images and video too of people, you know, putting bodies on a door that had been blasted in and carrying the person out on the door. You know, it is a perfect example of people making do with whatever they had available to take care of the people that they came across. And I'm really, you know, part of me, my educator brain and my my interest in this field wants to know what's going on, and I expect that there's going to be a really fascinating collection of after-action reports on this 6 months, a year from now. I'm sure Joe would agree that there's going to be some amazing information and lessons learned that will come out of this. And while this type of thing may never be seen, you know, this in this type of thing again specifically, there will be lessons learned here. And I'm sure that the medical community and the emergency response community will reach out and make sure that those lessons are disseminated. And I'm looking forward to that aspect of this because it's going to be a fascinating read, I suspect.
I agree, Jamie. This is pretty much a crucible of fire here in many ways. I certainly hope that all those that are able to respond to that hard-hit city are able to capture some lessons learned out of this. And, you know, if nothing else, it at least is an opportunity for us to learn how to deal with a mega disaster in the midst of another mega disaster and, you know, give us something going forward that we can utilize for the future.
Well, and you reminded me of something else too, Jamie, but when you're dealing with the part of the world that has had a lot of political strife and wars and bombings, these people are, like you were saying, taking somebody out of a house on the backboard. This is probably second nature to them. They have learned to be very creative and learned to be quite resilient. So hopefully that serves them well. Becky, you have a thought?
Yeah, so pandemic aside, I think it'd be really interesting to compare this explosion to similar explosions. For example, the Halifax explosion in 1917. Or the Black Tom explosion, and see, like, what have we learned? How have we evolved from how we respond to these types of disasters? I'm sure it's immense, particularly 100 years later. I think it'd be an interesting look back at emergency response, you know, in the early 1900s compared to 2000 with a similar type explosion.
Oh, good point. And I'm sure there's going to be plenty of books and articles on this, probably making that comparison, which makes a lot of sense. Even though this is very unique in many respects, there are a lot of similarities. Joe, can you talk a bit about pressure-related injuries in general and how those are treated? Because I'm thinking the people closest to the blast didn't survive anyway. So those that are still alive now are probably dealing with a lot of injuries. Like I'm thinking about ear injuries and that kind of thing. But what about pressure injuries to the chest and that kind of thing?
Well, you're exactly right, Sam. You know, that pressurization wave that's part of a massive explosion like that travels very quickly and travels a long way. And I think in many cases it is can be somewhat subtle in its injury pattern. Essentially what happens there is the damage occurs to any hollow structure inside the body. So you mentioned ears and lungs. The GI tract is particularly prone as well. And so what often happens is as the pressure wave sweeps over or through your body, the air is compressed dramatically over a very short period of time and then decompresses equally quickly. And that rapid compression, decompression stretches and tears tissue. And that's why you see lung injuries and latent bowel injuries. It often takes a little bit of time for the significant widespread sort of micro injury to capillary endothelium and vasculature and all that sort of stuff to begin to show itself. So, you know, in a lot of these folks, they'll obviously have some effect of the initial injury, but, you know, 6 hours later, they're suddenly severely short of breath, have developed pneumothoraces, are beginning to hemorrhage from their lungs and that sort of stuff. And so, these folks will crash and burn later on, and of course that makes for part of the challenge because initially You see kind of one set of injuries, a broken bone, et cetera. But then 6 hours later, you realize that they've got a ruptured abdominal viscus of some sort. Their gallbladder's exploded. Their lungs are bleeding everywhere. And all those things take some time before you see them. I think the other thing that we often don't think about is as we are doing a search for folks that are, for example, involved in a terrorist incident where there's an IED or something along those lines, you know, it's not uncommon to be yelling out or vocalizing, asking, you know, can anybody hear me? Come to my voice if you can hear me, or that sort of stuff. And then realizing that patients that you come across are not responding to you appropriately. They're not following commands well. They're looking at you sort of in a dumbfounded kind of way, as it were, and often misinterpreting a lot of that for brain injury and those sort of things, when in reality, those folks have had barotrauma to their ears and have ruptured their eardrums and simply can't hear you. So I think from in a blast type situation or an overpressure type situation, early on in those incidents, you need to be thinking about the fact that the folks that may have significant injuries may not be able to hear you calling for them or realize that someone is close or a dog is barking and alerting on them. They simply can't hear it. And to not misinterpret that as a brain injury or some other problem like that, but to simply recognize it as their hearing is gone because of the damage to their eardrums, et cetera.
Is that something that will come back, Joe, or is it permanently disabled?
Well, the answer is it's a spectrum, of course. You know, a tear in an eardrum can heal and do okay. It certainly depends on the amount of damage that's been done, etc. So in some of those cases, yes, they'll regain some, if not all, of their hearing, and in others the damage will be so substantial that they are unlikely to regain much hearing at all.
Wow. Becky, we're winded down here. You got some final thoughts?
Just a question, actually, and I apologize, this is probably a bit morbid, but we've seen, I think, death toll around 50, but I'm curious if there were people who were, you know, very close to the blast. Is it possible that there's no body left to find, and so we may never actually have an accurate death toll?
I think that's a great question, Becky. You know, I would certainly say that the majority of folks who were within a few hundred yards of that blast are completely gone, and that there is unlikely to find anything other than tiny remnants that no one may even identify as human remains, and that those people are indeed not able to be counted. I'd also suspect that there is a large number of folks that have yet to be found under debris and under collapsed structures. So, you know, I would expect this death toll to go up by probably an order of magnitude. I wouldn't be surprised if the final death toll is above 1,000 people, and that there are a large number of folks that will simply never be accounted for.
Shades of ground zero. Do you have any thoughts on the barotrauma, Jamie, or anything you want to add to that?
No, I think, you know, I defer to Joe on that stuff. You know, I think it's just incumbent upon all the responders in these types of situations where you do suspect some sort of blast injury, you know, to keep what Joe said in mind, that, you know, don't get distracted completely by, you know, a compound fracture. Deal with what you need to deal with in terms of your triage, but keep a suspicion in the back of your mind about other things that may be going on out of sight, and keep that in your diagnostic process as you deal with treating them and transporting them.
Exactly. Any final thoughts, Joe, on this whole thing? I know there's a lot more to come. right
yeah.
Now, I keep thinking something you said, you know, they're probably dealing with a lot of those secondary injuries now, a few days out. And there's probably not a whole lot they can do with these people, and that's pretty sad.
Well, and I think that's a good point. And, you know, to some extent, that kind of goes to Becky's comment earlier. You know, there are a very substantial number of people who have had significant barotrauma injury who will not survive the next few days because the medical system is unable to provide care for them. And so those folks will be part of the casualties of this explosion, but it'll take several days before they manifest the final results of that blast injury.
Not to mention what it's doing to the families that are still surviving. I don't even want to think about that.
Absolutely.
I got nothing else to say, Jamie. I'm giving it back to you.
Well, and you know, and a lot of the stuff we've talked about has been dealing with the lessons that we hope to learn from all of these types of situations so that when the next one comes along, we are in some small way prepared. And Joe, you know, it is the unexpected nature of disaster that makes it so hard to train for disaster preparedness. What is it that Paragon tries to do to bridge that gap?
Well, that's a great question, Jamie. You know, every one of these are different and more complex than the last. You know, this one we've been discussing tonight is just insane in its complexity. So, you know, I think all that you can do from a training standpoint is focus on basic principles that allow you to engage in those sort of things, think through what the issues are, and how you may be able to mitigate and respond. We try to craft our training programs to take into account sort of everything that might be part of a scenario like this. I'll have to admit we've not yet had a massive disaster of this scale and thrown in, oh, by the way, there's a pandemic. But that one's coming. So, you know, that'll be part of our training going forward.
Where can folks reach out to you if they want to learn more about the types of training, the different evolutions you have done in the past, and especially and most importantly, how you can customize a situation for their community and their system?
Yeah, we would love to talk to folks about how we can build a training program that suits their needs and addresses their issues. We'd ask for folks to come visit our website at paragonmedicalgroup.com or our Facebook page by the same name. Or they can certainly contact us through the Disaster Podcast or the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
Excellent. Thank you, Joe. Becky, where can folks find you?
I am hanging out on the Disaster Podcast Facebook page and, as always, on Twitter, talking about all the hurricane stuff and also on LinkedIn. Look me up there, Becky DePodwin. It's how it's spelled, how it sounds.
Excellent, Becky. We'll definitely do that. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, all the places that Becky hangs out under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, certainly in the Facebook group. And we love our community. They've added a lot to this discussion. And, oh, that was a question from Joe. We'll have to ask that. And on the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations, and I hope people will look me up and friend or follow me or otherwise connect with me, depending on how the platform calls it. But also, of course, in our Disaster Podcast Facebook group, which is continuing to grow and is ever more active. We certainly had a lot of activity on the post I put in there initially about this explosion, as a lot of people rallied in to share links, to share thoughts, connections that they had to the region and to people who knew people in the region. We hope, you know, down the road at some point, once the metaphorical smoke clears there, that we'll be able to bring you some semblance of an after action report of our own from a connection we might be able to pull together from the community. So folks that are in the community, if you're in the disaster podcast group, look up that post and check out the resources and links that have already been posted there. We had a lot of people reach out to us about things like blast injuries and training and education about these things, as well as about this specific incident and part of the world. So definitely something to keep track of. Sam, you know, this is like we've said throughout the entire podcast, this was an unprecedented incident that just kind of, you know, won't be necessarily replicated anytime soon. But yet we keep seeing that every disaster is unique and every situation carries with it its own unique hazards and own unique challenges for responders.
Well, I have to admit, Jamie, something that affects Dr. Joe to this extent has to be something out there, something serious and definitely out of the norm. So I think I'm going to end the show with a question. Is 2020 over yet?